Well, let's get started.
Obviously, the word got out on the first day, you know, 25 people. On the second day, there's three that hadn't heard about the court. My goal is to two things. One, I think this year will be remembered in the history of statistical education as the most important year for the past 20 years. Why? Two things are occurring this year. The update to the GAIS guidelines, a tremendous change. And I'm going to spend a third of my talk talking just about that part, because I think you need to hear about that. That isn't me, I'm just relaying a message, but I'm saying it's important. The second thing that's occurring this year is this conference. The topic of this conference, specifically social data, which by its nature is multivariate. Yet in most statistics books that I've used, I never see multivariate, unless there's a chapter near the end when my students are dead, about multivariate regression, and that's more complex than what they're willing to take on at that point. They just want to survive the final. So I think these two events are going to really mark, possibly, a change in statistical education, and that's what I want to talk about. Teaching social statistics. And I'm at Augsburg College, which is a small college, but the one benefit I have is I can teach what I want. There's no colleagues, no administrator. I've been the chair of my department. And so I get buy-in from all the other groups. I can do exactly what I want. I taught critical thinking for 15 years. I taught statistics for the same length of time. And then statistical literacy came along. I think Augsburg was the first college to have statistical literacy as a catalog course. That was over 20 years ago. So we've had a lot of experience there with students. And for the past 4 or 5 years, we've been teaching the course that I want to talk about today. Because the statistical literacy course is more of a critical thinking course. How strongly does the data support a non-statistical argument? We should do this, we shouldn't do this, etc. That's beyond where most statistics professors are comfortable. Definitely. So where I'm looking is where the argument involves a statistic as the conclusion. Not as a premise. That goes into critical thinking. But as a conclusion, what shaped this statistic? How could it have been defined differently? Why did they choose the particular definition they did? Or if you don't even know the definition, what could they have chosen to make it go up and get down? So I want to talk about that. And I want to offer you more assertions per unit time than any other session here. We've all been to enough conferences. You've heard the t-test ad nauseum. And lately, you know, randomization, you know. I want to offer more assertions. You may not agree, I don't care, but it gets your mind going. And that's why we go to conferences. I figure if I get a couple new ideas at a conference, I'm happy. So, jumping to the point, because I'm in business, I want to sell you on this, that StatEd should offer 3 intro stat courses. Stat 100, a statistical literacy in the media, which is more of a critical thinking course, a bit on how the statistics are formed, but then where do you go with that, etc. Stat 101, that's the traditional course. We all know it's been the same for 50 years. I've got a textbook from 1955. I could teach from it. No problem. I know exactly what chapter 4, conditional probability, that I'm talking about. And I'm saying we need to offer a third course. I call Stat 102, Statistics for Decision Makers, which is focusing on social data, specifically multivariate observation data. And I'll give reasons for this, and then how do you teach it? Because that's different. It's easy to teach 101. It's hard to get the students to understand it, but the concepts are relatively simple and straightforward. Once you really understand randomization, either in sampling or assignment, and you can see what the sampling distribution represents, it's like, oh. But this is much more complex, and I'm only talking about things that I have experienced. I have taught this for 4 years, so I've learned a lot. Some of the things I tried didn't work. And so I've divided my presentation up into 3 parts. The first first part is on the basics of this. The second part is reviewing the multivariate thinking from the GAIS guidelines to inform you on that and to show some additional ways to do the things they're asking us to do. Because I've got 5 additional techniques. And the third, what about inference? That's the big question. You could add all this stuff, but what about inference? Are we going to skip it? What are we going to do that allows us to feel professionally responsible to our discipline? So, moving forward, what are social statistics? First assertion, that's the wrong place to start. I told you, more assertions per unit time. The first step determines the journey. The first question should be, what are statistics? You're saying, Milo, we know statistics. And I'm saying, no. We carry 2 definitions, and we switch between them seamlessly. I consider the different answers here the biggest fundamental problem in statistics education. Because when we use the word statistics, there's an ambiguity there. And we use it to our advantage. Let me show you. I could say it's quantitative data from random samples, because that's what happens in chapter 4 or 5 when we get into randomization. We talk about statistics are what? The properties of samples. There's where the switch occurred. Up in the first 3 chapters, statistics were populations, administrative data, anything. The minute we get to chapter 4, statistics suddenly become the properties of samples, preferably random samples, because we can't do anything with convenience. And I'm saying, that's not nice. I would say numbers in context where the context matters, and that covers both. And I want to stay with that second definition, because that's going to determine a different course than if I go with the first. So, you really need, especially if you come from a math stat background, you need to think clearly about the difference between math and statistics. It's sometimes easy to forget what that difference is operationally. With math, you abstract out the context. That's what makes it beautiful. Okay? You don't deal with the nature of the thing. You have a variable. That's it. It has no identity, no nature. It has values, etc. You talk about associations and covariates, properly speaking. And there is no operator for causes in mathematics. Causes is a material relationship. Math is a formal discipline. We have necessary and sufficient, but we don't have a causal operator unless you're DJ a Pearl. Okay?
Milo, are you taking questions as we go along? Or?
Yes.
When you talked about definitions of statistics, you focused on the data in both cases.
Yes.
But when I think of statistics, I think of, in mathematics, the field of probability and statistics, where the statistics is a branch of mathematics. So
and I want to argue the opposite, and I've got 4 more slides on that. So hold your question until I finish 4 more slides, because to me that's a really big point. I see mathematics as a subset of statistics, another assertion, and that's coming up.
That's another meaning of statistics that we seamlessly jump around with.
We'll see here in a second. Yes?
Just a brief comment. Although it's mostly true of what you presented on the slide, mathematical modeling has the same problem as statistical modeling because of the context. So when you're talking about mathematical modeling, they have the same problem as statistical modeling.
If you're talking about, usually that's econometrics, etc. And I would consider that with business, and that's where I'm saying we need to go. Whereas statistics, using the second definition, where you're talking about the data where it has a nature. It may be a human being, it may be a mouse, but it has a nature. It has characteristics, and the characteristics don't follow analytic functions. And we talk about causes and confounders. Properly speaking, confounder involves things that have natures. It's not there's a difference between a covariate and a confounder. Confounder is a covariate where the confounder can influence, can cause a change in the outcome. And it's related to the predictor. But a covariate is just related. It's just related. So to me, numbers are statistics where you've taken the context away. 2 apples, 2 oranges, 2 potatoes, 2. And so I see mathematics as a branch of statistics. I know because we start with math that we say, oh, it's numbers, and then we add the context. But that's not how it occurs in reality. We sense things in context, and then we abstract. Okay, so this affects the definition. We might say statistics involves variability, which is another way of talking about data, because data by its nature is variable unless it's coming off an analytic function or something like that. And so I could talk about math, probability, etc., and say, oh, math and calculus are over here, probability and all that, that's under the variability side, that's statistics. That's definition number one. But if I'm using definition number two, it's the context that matters. I can do a math stat probability class, and the natures don't matter. I say, I've got a random sample of things, and that's all I know about them. They're really just things that have values, the values have variables, that's it. So I'm saying again that this definition really matters, and that's going to affect what I'm going to be teaching in this course. So, two definitions of social statistics. It's data, sample data, specifically random sample data using social conditions, typically surveys. You're in the sampling margin of error in lives. I could teach that coming off a regular stat course. But if I'm looking at the second definition, all data involving social conditions. I mean, quantitative data I should have here because there's text data that I'm not analyzing. Most of this data is population data. Gapminder statistics are population. They're not doing random samples to get that stuff. I don't know that. I'll back off. A lot of it is longitudinal. How often do you see a time series graph in a statistics textbook? Why not? We know that's too complex. There's a whole course on time series. My students will never see that course. My students are business majors. They are concerned about time. And finally, the data is primarily observational data. Most textbooks don't even mention observational data. Or if they do, it's like that. Don't go there. My students, that's what they're dealing with. So, you can see how the two definitions lead to two different courses. And all the slides will be up on the web, so you don't have to do that. DeVoe made it a little stronger. At a previous conference, he said, we teach the wrong stuff the wrong way in the wrong order. Very provocative. But anybody can be provocative as a critic. Can you give an example and show how it can be done better? I want to give an example of something I did wrong for at least 20 years and how I've corrected it. I taught association is not causation. Now, I used the example of the Berkeley sex discrimination. I talked about ice cream sales and burglaries. What's wrong with that? I didn't know it was wrong. I taught it for 20 years. Until one day I thought, both of these examples involve confounding. Is confounding the point of this textbook I'm teaching? They will never see that again in the textbook. Never. Textbook is about randomization. What I need is an example of how randomness can create an association. That's the point of my course. So the first day, I walk into the class with a jar of quarters. I pass them out, no introduction, and I say, one of you has special powers, and we're going to find out who you are. Flip 10 times, record the outcomes, give me the longest run of either heads or tails. How many? Two. How many? Five. How many? Three. Da, da, da. And somebody comes up with seven. And I say, seven. Is that a very likely outcome that you could flip the same thing seven times in a row? These are not math geniuses, but they're dimly aware that's extremely unlikely. What can we conclude because we have our first statistic? A, the person has special powers, or, and I don't say anything here, what word do you suppose my students use to answer that question? What word? Probability? No.
Chance?
Not chance, but it's a C word. I expected chance, but I learned to wait. It's a different word than chance, but it's a synonym. We would consider it. We would say chance. Coincidence. Oh, coincidence. Yeah, we know about coincidence. We've all had these strange coincidences. You go to a foreign city and you meet a friend from high school or whatever. And I'll say, okay. So, how do we determine whether it's special powers or coincidence? And I wait. And what does somebody say?
Try it again.
Exactly. In the first 3 minutes, I've got the two big ideas of statistics that an association could be coincidence. Because they know that that flipping of coins should be coincidence, unless you have special powers, or it's coincidence. And they can immediately say, repeat it. And I say, fine. What happens if we can't repeat it? And I say, oftentimes, that's what we're dealing with in life. We have statistics. If we could repeat, we could learn a lot more. But typically, we can't repeat. And that's why we need to think critically. And that's the introduction to my course. Okay. So, blah, da, 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 we've done that. Okay. So let's talk about some social statistics to get an idea. China used more cement in 3 years than the U.S. used in the entire 100 years of the 20th century. Class, can you give me some explanations as to why this might be? What could explain underneath the statistic here how China used more cement in 3 years than we used in 100 years? Anyway, because there's a half a dozen explanations for this, and that's what I want my students to get into the habit of, is thinking of alternate explanations for things, because I'm headed toward confounders. This is just the first step.
Well, I'm a little confused, I mean, because there's no causal claim here. I mean,
no.
The simplest answer is just that they use 3 times more cement.
That could be.
Period.
There's nothing else. It's just, you know, it's just a fact. There's nothing else that influences it. They like cement. They didn't have any trees, you know, whatever. What's another explanation? Are the countries the same size? They're talking about China now and the U.S. then. One possible effect. What are some other possible explanations as to why China might have used more cement than we do?
Population,
right? Another one might be, maybe we build our houses out of wood. Maybe they build everything out of cement. I don't know. Maybe we have treated wood, so we can build skyscrapers out of wood. And China doesn't have treated wood. They have to build everything out of cement. Maybe they're trying to build their towns in smaller spaces where we would build 1, 2, and 3 story. Everything is 20 story.
Okay. When you have a building boom, you know, like we had maybe building booms in the 1800s, and whereas they had it obviously.
It's all been compressed into 3 years. It's a compression thing. And so, but that's what I want my students to get started with, is hypothetical thinking. They need that to think about confounders. And they're not accustomed to that kind of thinking in any math class, ever, and not in many of their other classes. But this is a different class. We're talking where the context matters. So, how about the office desk? 400 times bacteria as a toilet seat. Well, what could explain this? Well, cleaning. They clean the toilets. We don't clean our office. We scrape the desk. We push the stuff off the desk. What else? Because I say, the first one is usually easy, the second is harder, the third, what's some more explanations? I expect my students, they can come up with 3 or 4, because I work them every class on this. What's another explanation for why the desk has more bacteria? Now, I'm looking at this desk, and I'm looking at this toilet seat. What else could be going on here?
This desk is used for more purposes.
Okay, used more often. I spend more time at my desk, hopefully, than at the toilet. Okay. Yes, sir?
Your hands are near your elbow, your back note.
I didn't quite catch that, or maybe I don't want to.
Oh, that's right. Too much information.
Okay. Anything else?
The desk is
big. If the desk is 400 times the size of the toilet, once we take into per square centimeter, they might be the same. Okay? Now, this is not math. But it is statistics. It is statistics. What you take into account influences the association. And that's what the course is about. Okay. So, you get the idea. So, how should we teach the course? Wrong question again. Why? You don't start with your material. I'm in a business department, and in business we survive as long as the customer values us. People that have given the stat before and after attitude survey, students see less value in statistics after the course than before. It's a sad survey. Sad survey. I'll talk about at the end how my students see the course. So I think we need to start about who are the students? What are their goals, meaning what's their major? What are they interested in? I'm not talking sports, weather, finance, but their major. How can I support their major? And their attitudes. Okay, so here's the distribution of students in the U.S. by major. I can talk later about how I got this because it isn't tabulated normally. And when I was at the ASA, I asked the teachers in attendance, where are you from? You can see that the teachers are not representative of the students in their disciplines. No surprise. And I'm saying these first three disciplines, 70%, are the ones that are primarily observational. Whereas the next three tend to be more random assignment controlled in some way. But regardless, most of the teachers, NASDAQ, are not there. We need to start with what do these students need that I can teach them that will help them, that they can see value. Right now, we have a captive audience. They are delivered to us by the majors. But to be in business, you have to add value. Okay, so I'm going to skip that. That's the value thing. I'm saying we have three audiences. Three audiences, and that's why I'm arguing we need three courses. There's the consumer citizen audience, basically students in majors that don't have a quantitative requirement. Art, music, English, maybe political science, maybe history, definitely philosophy. And certainly they need observational studies. At the top, we have the group that are going to go on, hopefully, to be researchers. Research in psychology, marketing, people in business, etc. And they need the traditional 101 course. That's why it's there. It's a foundation for 201. This is the group I'm interested in. The decision makers, primarily your management, marketing people in business. They're interested in observational studies and, most importantly, quasi-experiments. Very few textbooks mention quasi-experiments. That's central to what we need to be talking about. Central, based on the students. Okay, so we need to drop the idea of the course and offer three courses, like I say, 100, 101, 102, some algebra, most algebra, little algebra, and I think at least half of the intro sections ought to be the 102. Because at least half the students are in those majors. Now, if you're just teaching psychology students, that doesn't count, or if you're just teaching engineering. But overall, so what we did in our department, because nobody has money or time for a new course, we had six sections of statistics a year. We took half of them, converted it to this, and we told our business management marketing majors, you can take either 101 or 102. If you think you're going on to grad school, I take this one. If not, you can think about it. I don't want to cut anybody off from going to the regular class, but I do want to give them an option of this class. And people sort themselves out. I'm teaching both classes, so it's not a teacher problem, okay? And when I'm teaching this one, I'm excited about this one. I mean, I'm not bad-mouthing. You got to love what you're teaching. So, let's talk about association versus causation. My students, when they think of association, they think of the National Basketball Association. They're so far away from where we start. And when we say as X increases, Y decreases, that's still far away. They're typically comparing groups. They're into discrete comparisons, group comparisons. And so they may say, oh, bachelor's degree, 62% more. And in their mind, they say, oh, if I get a BA, I can expect, I mean, not individually, but expect in some general sense, that I can make 62% more. Now, this is association, this is causation, right? They don't really see the difference. They don't really see the difference. And so you have to say, well, supposing you really were at the bottom of the SAT, ACT college qualification thing, do you suppose you can expect to earn 62% more? The same as the person that got the highest score? And they're going, well, probably not. Probably not. So this is true if you're the average person in the group. This is true if you're the average person in the group. So to say you doesn't mean you as Milo. It's you as an average person selected from the group at random. Oh, they don't see that under the word you. Okay? But that's what you're dealing with is ordinary English. Ordinary English or in the language you're teaching from. You have to worry about the language. I spend more time on language than I ever dreamed I would in teaching statistics. Okay, so here we have some associations in a great new book by Gary Smith. Baseball players whose names begin with D are more likely to die young. You say, well, if I took all the letters and all the death rates, isn't somebody more likely to die young than somebody else? Well, yeah. And do you suppose this is, could it be statistically significant? Well, it depends on how many baseball players they had, right? Is it material, would be how an accountant would frame it. What's the effect size here? And I'm preparing the students for effect size because that's really big when you talk about confounding. Okay, whereas this one is a different kind of thing. It will add, it increases. Action verbs in English connotate causation. Somebody did something. It's the most common way that associations are framed in the media because they connote. They give your mind reason to think this is a causal claim. Could we do a before-after experience on this type of thing? We'll let you drink coffee, see how many years it adds to your life, and then rerun the experiment with you and see, take away the coffee and see if you live longer? No, we can't, Rob, right? No, you can't.
Not ethically.
No. It's not unethical. It's impossible. I have to wait until you die. So I can't do it. It's not an ethical thing. I see how long you live with a pot of coffee a day, and then I take it away, bring you back to life, and run it's impossible to do this as a before after. And so by that, I realized that had to be a cross-sectional comparison of two groups. And somebody took that association, which should have been said, those that drink a full pot of coffee will live longer than those that don't. Two separate groups. But they translate it into this will add and increases action verb language. And most people don't see this is an association masquerading as a causal claim. Okay.
Can I take that? I think part of the issue isn't that they see, most people don't see that as a causation. Well, that, I don't want to say quite like that. But the notion of a probabilistic causation is foreign to most people.
Well, what would they say? Drinking one cup a day increases.
Well, so that's the clearest causal statement.
Okay, so the first, okay,
yeah.
So the, skip the set. Will add years to your life?
On average.
That's too much of a statistical thing, and they probably would. I'd agree with you on that one. I should just stick with the second one where it's clearer.
Yeah.
Yep, good point. Okay, or you get this, you know, what does it mean to fuel a ride? Is this an association claim? Is this a causal claim? It's all gray in the middle, and most of the claims are these gray claims in the middle. So you need to spend some time on grammar. Do you realize that people that have more birthdays live longer? And you're saying, this is not what I'm talking about. This is an associate. Well, it's kind of like causal, but it's not causal the way I'm thinking. You need to be able to talk to your students about in what way is this causal? It's a necessary condition. It's a sufficient condition. But to say it's causal, you need to untangle some of these things. Or marriage is the leading cause for divorce. You're like, wait a minute, that's a necessary condition. Do we call necessary conditions cause? They need help on what a cause is. They really need help. So this applies to any course. What I want to do is head into what I consider the most rapidly growing kind of social statistics. I talked to the editor of the U.S. Statistical Abstract. He said, this kind of statistic will never appear in my book. Most people don't realize that's an association-based statistic. Epidemiologists have things that they call the percentage attributable to, and you could use that to give the number of deaths attributable to something. And my students can work problems on this and know how it's done. It's duck simple. But most people think, oh, a coroner had a body and looked at the body and said, oh, air pollution, overweight. And it's like, I don't think you can do that as a coroner. Too much salt? No. In fact, in the death things, you don't see deaths from secondhand smoke. You do see deaths from primary smoke. The coroner can tell the difference in the lungs of a primary smoker as to whether that caused it or not. Because some smokers have very healthy looking lungs, some non-smokers have unhealthy looking lungs, but a coroner can tell in which cases the smoking and the thing were connected, but not secondhand smoke. So they have to realize that these are what I call speculative statistics, spotty statistics. But it's a rapidly growing one. They had the number of deaths due to diesel trucks on a segment of highway in Massachusetts. And pretty soon everybody's going to have this kind of statistic on their operation. Here was a particular study where 45,000 uninsured died. And here were 11 news stories on the same event. And I want you to focus on the verb, die, attributable to, associated with, tied to, linked to, from lack of, due to. Now we're headed into a different realm, because of. And you can almost see causality is coming. And then we have an action verb, kills. And then finally we have the big C, cause. And then it goes even further, blameworthy. Moral causation. This is all from the same story. Initially, my students don't see any difference here. It's all the same. You need to spend more time on helping them distinguish association from causation. So we need to do observational things. It's harder to do observational courses. There's more factors. And what the students need is a structure that they can group all the influences into three or four categories. And so this is the structure that I use. I have the typical randomness and error, because those are the ones we teach in our regular course. Everything else went into two categories. Confounding, what was and what was not controlled for, and what kind of study was involved. And then what I call assembly, or you might call assumptions. How were the statistics selected? How were they defined? How were the groups defined? How were the measurements conducted? How were they grouped, summarized, compared, and presented? All of that type of stuff where people have choice. This is the social construction of statistics from a sociological point of view. And since I have trouble remembering things, I put this under one of the oldest human admonitions, take care. And that certainly applies to statistics. I don't think my students remember much of my course. I didn't remember much of the courses I took. But I figure if they could remember take care with statistics, and hopefully they might remember these four. That would be pretty good. And I survey my students at the end. They said this was the most important thing they got out of the course. And it's open-ended. I don't give them any choices. I just say, talk to me about what it was. And then I take all of those, put it into a thing, and say, hey, what do you consider number one, etc. So, the way I see it is, the statistic is like the foundation to a house. That's the critical thinking. There's a point they're trying to make, and how steady are the walls, how good is the foundation. What we're interested in is where the statistics are the conclusion. And here are all the influences coming in. That's what my course is about, the relationship between this and this. So that's how I separate critical thinking from what I call statistical literacy, or whatever you want to call it, I don't care. How did that happen? The U.S. in the 2009, 27,000, 2010, almost 10 times more. What happened? Change in definition. Bang. Okay? Or I gave you some money, you guaranteed a 20% return on my investment? No, I guaranteed a 20% return of your investment. Just a small change in the words changes everything. This is where the context changes the meaning. That's what I want my students to see. Moore, in Concepts and Controversies, has one example of this. Took me a while to find it. What's a smoker? 20% of adolescents smoke, meaning smoked at least once in the past month. Whereas he says, if a smoker is somebody that smoked on 20 of the past 30 days and smoked at least half a pack, it drops to 4%. And students say, I got it. This is a math class. This is simple. I can see this. And so I give them a definition of what a smoker is, and I say, can you rewrite this definition to increase the number? Can you rewrite the definition to decrease the number? And after a while, they get pretty good at that. That's what I want them to realize. It's the definition that drives the statistic. The statistic is the tail. The definition is the dog. Okay. NASLG had this thing on a fish, and it made it look really bad. Chicago, don't eat fish in Chicago. 46% or N, whatever that is, until you realize that the chemicals are 7 nanograms per gram of fish. That's 7 parts in a million. Now, if we looked at 7 parts in a million, it might be a little fly speck in the middle, right? How did the person get this? They took 100% of the chemicals. This is like a kind of a pie chart of where the chemicals are distributed. There isn't anything here that tells you it's teeny. It's teeny. Now, is this wrong? No, it's a factual thing. 46% of the chemicals in the fish are N. But most people go away saying, my God, I didn't realize it was that bad. Isn't there any part of the fish that's healthy? It's not wrong, but it's buyer beware when it's statistics. There's no national agency that determines these things. So why don't teachers want to teach this? Because I'm in business and I look at the arguments both sides. Ordinary English is a mess. I don't want to teach it. Probability of A given B, I can teach that. Leave this up to the subject matter experts. I'm here to teach statistics, not to teach English grammar. It's not really statistics, blah, blah, blah. And I'd counter and say, ordinary English or the ordinary everyday languages help my students communicate. And if we don't do it, they'll never see it. And I'm saying we can teach it without subject matter expertise. Which is bigger in this class? The number of students? The number of male students? Or the number of students that are already in the class and are waiting to get into the class? The student doesn't really have to know what male means. All they have to know is that an adjective is like an and. It restricts. So I could put X there. It wouldn't matter. This is going to be smaller. The minute I say or, it gets larger. Okay? It takes a while for students to do this and realize, oh, I don't need any subject matter expertise. And I've worked quite hard to come up with exercises that don't require subject matter expertise. And finally, I'm going to skip this. I think we should talk about what are the most important contributions of statistics to human knowledge. I'm doing that at ASA in 2 weeks, so I'm going to skip that part. I ask my students, what do they think is most important? I take their open-ended things, turn them into options, and then ask them what are their top three. Number one, some structure for classifying. I don't care whether it's a three-factor, four-factor, five-factor. I don't care whether it's mine or yours. I don't care. But some structure. Confounding was number two. What I call hypothetical thinking. What could confound? How could the measurements have been different? That's not a skill they get in other classes. They thought that was tied here for number two. Statistics are more than numbers. I was surprised they put that one up there. I mean, that's how I express it. But I didn't expect them to see that as that valuable. I thought they'd be into more concrete things. And I didn't expect bias to pop up here, but it did. And what I call ratio grammar, percent and percentages and so forth, that's a whole other area. But this is what they selected, 58 students, based on it. And some of them are doing this online. So it isn't a teacher effect that I'm inculcating. I don't know what it is. Hey, they've got a textbook. They've got exercises. That's it. So that's the first part. The second part, so if you want to stand up for a section, I don't know, I can only take about 30 or 40 minutes of listening to anybody, including myself. So if you want to stand up for a few minutes, I'm going to eat a grape or two and get ready for the second part here. Because that's me. Yes.
We have 2 minutes break.
2 minutes.
Okay.
I'll wait for you to come back. Zero. One.